This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.
Today is Dr. Jeff Babb. Dr. Babb, welcome.
It's good to be here.
So, among many other topics, Dr. Babb is our East Asia specialist, and today we're going to talk about one of the most important, probably forgotten wars in modern history, and that's the Russo-Japanese War. So, let's start on the Russian side, which I think is a little bit easier for people to wrap their minds around. By the end of the 19th century, Russia is a giant land empire. It's got maritime aspirations. It sprawls across two continents. So what position is Russia in the lead up to this war in the early 20th century?
Let me quickly go through that, and let me start in 1860. With the Treaty of Beijing,
okay.
When Russia was ceded, what is now the Russian Far East, where Vladivostok is, and that area was previously China, but it was ceded to Russia, which immediately brought it into conflict with Japan, who had pieces of that as well. So if you look at the Sakhalin Island piece, and the areas that are still under dispute today in the northern Kurils, this is really the beginning of when the Russians and the Japanese will start to cast eyes at each other. And especially when you look at the Korean Peninsula, which is which will be taken by the Japanese in the 1894-95 war. The other important piece when we're looking at the Russians and this is the slow deterioration of the Tsar's regime. And in 1905, there's a mini revolution that is a precursor to what's coming in 1917, and that has a direct effect on the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-05, in that Russia cannot send additional ground forces out there. Not to mention the fact that the line of communication from European Russia to the Far East part of Russia is a single rail line that is always under repair, always in problems, and still is today. It's a matter, you know, there's a rail line across there that's well taken care of, and you know you can still travel from Moscow to Vladivostok, but it is a long line, and I remember even talking about it as our relationship with China was growing in the 70s and 80s of the possibilities of cutting that rail line that was out there to cause problems for the Russians. So at that time, the Soviets. So at the end of the day, then as we begin to look at the rise of these. Of this problem between Russia and Japan, I think a good place to start is in the 1860s, and if you will, I'll just move right on to the Meiji.
So it sounds like you're saying is Russia on a map is this giant country that looks like it should control North Asia, but in reality, it's a paper tiger. There's problems at home, and its military forces, army and navy, are in Europe, not in Asia.
And one thing is like in a lot of the popular literature, Russia is often seen as kind of the least modern, least advanced of, and is it even truly a European power?
Right.
Is that a true assessment, or is there perhaps a little bit of nuance there?
Actually, when I look at their forces that were out in the Far East, given the numbers that they had there, they caused significant problems for the Japanese, and the Japanese suffered horrendous casualties during this war. Mm-hmm. So in terms of a modern army with modern artillery, small arms, and a vision for how to fight on land, the Russians actually, although they were the least prepared out here in the Far East, mm-hmm. They still acquitted themselves very well.
Okay, so let's talk about the kind of the Japanese side, who, spoilers, will be the victors in this war. So Japan traditionally up until kind of the mid-19th century has been an insular, inward-looking society. So first of all, what changes? What causes them to look outwards?
The biggest change is what is called by some the Meiji Restoration. One of our former instructors, Tom Huber, wrote a book that is still a classic, and he calls it the Meiji Revolution. Hmm. And it is a revolution in many, many ways for the Japanese. Mm-hmm. They will, beginning in 1868, begin a massive change towards what we would call modernization. Mm-hmm. And they will modernize not only their military, both ground forces and naval forces, they're going to modernize their way of government. Mm-hmm. The Meiji Restoration is kind of a strange term in that the Meiji emperor will be restored, but he becomes... It's not exactly the figurehead like you would like we would call the king or queen of England today, but more of a figurehead than before.
Right.
During the so we have the Meiji Restoration. There's a new Meiji emperor is put back on the throne, and we will begin to see the building of a modern army and navy. Mm-hmm. The army model will first be France, and then after the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71, the model would become the Germans. Mm-hmm. At sea, from the very beginning, the model is Britain. Mm-hmm. And they will begin to buy ships, buy equipment, and model their armies in terms of training and organization after the Germans. They will have a test case. As a matter of fact, I will talk about two test cases. In 1894-95, mm-hmm. they will, in a dispute over influence on the Korean Peninsula, go to war with China. And this would be like Canada attacking the United States.
Right.
The world thought, oh, the Japanese will certainly lose this. The Chinese have overwhelming forces. In the 1870s, the Chinese had started something called the self-strengthening movement, where they had been buying modern equipment from European nations and the United States, for that matter. Mm-hmm. We were selling them small arms. So in 1894-95, it is a staggering defeat for the Chinese. Mm-hmm. As part of this 100 years or century of humiliation, they are truly humiliated, mm-hmm. especially by this defeat by the Japanese. It's one thing to be defeated by Western powers, but be defeated by an Asian enemy that they'd been fighting since the Han Dynasty in the 200 BC area. Japan was always a problem for the Chinese, especially because of their piracy.
Right.
But Korea was the place where it all got started. At the end of that war, at the Treaty of Shimonoseki, Taiwan is ceded to Japan, and it mm-hmm. will stay under Japanese control for the next 50 years. In addition, the port of Dalian, Port Arthur, that area at the very tip of the Liaodong Peninsula, was initially given to Japan. Mm-hmm. But France, Germany, and Russia in the Triple Entente had basically said, no. Mm-hmm. And so there was a trade-off. China had to pay an additional indemnity to Japan, but Japan did not get control of the Port Arthur Dalian area. And that will become important because that's where the Russians are.
Right.
Because the Russians then leased it from the Chinese. Mm. And so we'll move from influence in Korea, which will be Japanese, to now looking at Manchuria mm-hmm. and what's known as the Liaodong Peninsula all the way up to the city of Mukden, which today is Shenyang.
Now, before we go too much further, so why were the Japanese so successful against the Chinese during this time frame? Was it just they were better, obviously, but why?
China is suffering from both internal and external divisions. And so in 1894-95, the Qing Dynasty is incapable of putting together what it needs to both fight off the foreign influences and the increasing influences within. The Qing Dynasty is made up of the Manchus, and they came to power in 1644. Mm-hmm. So whether you believe in a dynastic cycle and decay or not, they were decaying. And so they were spread out everywhere. These original Manchurian banners that had been such wonderful warriors in the 1600s have slowly deteriorated over time. But probably the biggest thing is the leadership of China is Confucian, and it believes more in the archaic than it does in the future. So while there are some within China that are really pushing towards modernization, there's too many in the Qing leadership that don't. And especially the Empress Dowager, who we're going to see in a few minutes when we talk about the Boxer Rebellion. She is very anti-modernization, or at least appears to be. And she prevents the young emperor from actually having making these changes in the early 1890s. So they basically don't modernize. But even if they had, they have so many internal problems of anti-Qing activity, and these external problems caused by, one might argue that hubris. They maintained this idea of the Middle Kingdom and this idea that the rest of the world should pay tribute to the central government, to the emperor, far too long.
So you have a hungry, modernizing power against an archaic power that is not that is struggling with itself.
Yes. Yes.
So, second obvious question, but I think it's worth talking about. Why does Japan want mainland territory? Why do they want, at the time it was called Formosa, what is now Taiwan?
Yeah. Why do they want Taiwan and Manchuria? The island nation of Japan is very resource poor. And as they were watching the European nations in the colonization of the globe, mm-hmm. Japan basically said, we have to have a part of that. Mm-hmm. We are so resource poor. And so their model is the United Kingdom. And so it needed colonies. Mm-hmm. And so the first colony is Korea. The first colonies will be Korea and Taiwan, although they're not really called colonies. It won't be until 1910 that Korea will become an official colony. And Taiwan is just Taiwan. It's theirs. Mm-hmm. And which is still problematic today, as mm-hmm. The U.S. bases in Japan will be critical for any kind of defense of Taiwan should that become necessary in the future. So this goes a long ways back. This mm-hmm. this island chain that will run from Sakhalin through Japan to Taiwan, then to the Philippines, mm-hmm. which we will take in 1898, and it will become our colony. This is all part of Japan looking at the Western powers, mm-hmm. Europe and America, and seeing a model. And that model is they must have colonies. And they need Manchuria. Manchuria is a very resource-rich area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we have a successful Japanese war against the Chinese. As you mentioned, it probably shocked the world that the Japanese defeated the great imperial power. So where do we go from here? What happens in the aftermath of the war?
There are rail lines that are being built through Manchuria, mm-hmm. down to the Russian port of Port Arthur. And so as the rail lines will start, there's an east-west rail line that will end up in Vladivostok. Well, the easiest way for that to happen is to go across Manchuria. And then there's a spur that goes from that main line that would goes all the way from Moscow to Vladivostok, all the way down to the end of the Liaodong Peninsula. Mm-hmm. So this, in a lot of ways, is about railroads. Mm. And railroads are about the shipment of both raw materials and finished goods. And so it's a fight over railroads. It's a fight over ports. And it's a fight over resources. Mm-hmm. And it almost comes to a head in and around the time where the Boxer Rebellion flares up in China. So when the Boxer Rebellion flares up in China, the Japanese will be the largest military contingent, and the Russians will be the second largest military contingent in the Boxer Rebellion. And then from that Boxer Rebellion, of which the United States will have over 2,000 troops as part of it as well, this really will be the end of the Qing Dynasty. Mm-hmm. It will last another decade, but it's on its way out. The Empress Dowager sneaks out of the city dressed as a peasant. And there's a huge indemnity that the Chinese have to pay. And Russia and Japan are now sitting beside each other because we'll be part of the occupation force. So Japanese forces at the Boxer Rebellion are about 20 to 25,000. And then there's like 50,000 Russians that are up in Manchuria, and they will send the second largest contingent down to Beijing. So what you have are two large forces sitting next to each other, mm-hmm. both coveting the same territory.
Right.
So you have both the Japanese and the Russians, both of whom are looking to exploit the resources, particularly of northern China. One kind of an established power, although perhaps a little bit creaky around the edges, and one just kind of sees himself as the up-and-comer and wanting to prove themselves as basically part of the imperialist club.
Yes.
Is that a good way to put it?
No, that's a great way to put it.
So the Boxer Rebellion roils China, as you say. It's the end of the dynasty, if not on paper. What are these forces doing that is useful to them? Obviously, they're occupying space to try to get something out of some kind of settlement. But are they doing any fighting, or are they just in garrison?
I think the best thing, the best comparison would be it's a peacekeeping and stabilization force. Because of what the Chinese did in and around the legation, that group of embassies in Peking, and putting them under risk. As a matter of fact, there was a report in the New York Times during the period that the Chinese forces had actually taken the legation and massacred all the people in it. Mm. That had not really happened. It was a false report.
Right.
But what happened then after the Boxer Rebellion with the Boxer Indemnity is that the nations that had taken part in this relief expedition formed a corridor from Beijing to the sea. Mm-hmm. So it goes Beijing to Tianjin to the Daku forts. And that corridor was being maintained. And our forces, the United States Army will actually be in China from 1900 to 1938. Mm-hmm. And so we have a garrison permanent garrison, 2012, right after the revolution, to 1938, mm-hmm. We have the 15th Infantry Regiment, mm-hmm. and it has some very famous people that will be there.
George Marshall.
Marshall, and Stilwell, mm-hmm. And Wedemeyer, and others that will become famous in China had served there during that time period. So we are maintaining a corridor to the sea. Mm-hmm. That regiment works as much for the State Department as it works for anybody else. Mm-hmm. Now, we have an adjunct problem, which is the Navy. Mm-hmm. The United States Navy will actually patrol the internal waters of China, something called the Yangtze River Patrol, Yangpat, from 1854 until 1941. Mm. And so there are Marines also there along with the Navy. So you'll see Marines in Shanghai and Beijing. Then you see all the Army there. So the U.S. is there, but all the colonial powers are there as well. In a visit to Chongqing, there was a French garrison in Chongqing, and they still have remnants of that station there. Mm-hmm. It was kind of fascinating, mm-hmm. And of course the Brits are down in Hong Kong,
right.
And the Germans are in Qingdao. Mm-hmm. Again, everybody picks their, you know, their area, mm-hmm. and they're not really colonies. They're called concessions,
right.
But for all intents and purposes, these are key areas, especially around the most important ports, mm-hmm. and the capital, where foreign powers will essentially look over the shoulder of the Chinese government. Well, mm-hmm. that's good until 1912, but after 1912, the Chinese government that gets formed actually becomes very anti-foreign.
Perhaps understandably so.
Yes.
Now, as we take a look at the kind of backing up to right after the Boxer Rebellion, so you have the Japanese forces there, you have the Russian forces there. I know there are other nations doing those things, but for the Japanese and Russians, are they interested in protecting trade interests, or are they interested in exploitation of Chinese resources?
Both.
Okay, so which one's kind of the bigger one?
I think it's resources.
Okay.
Manchuria is a rich area for resources. There are two major industrial areas of China, basically up in the Shenyang, what's then called Mukden region, and then in Wuhan up the river from Shanghai and Nanjing. So it's resources.
Okay,
predominantly.
So we've got these forces. They're in friction at this particular stage in the game.
Yep.
So how do we get to the next stage?
It's a very long involved story from basically the 1890s all the way up to war breaks out, at first undeclared and then declared. It is a series of give and take in terms of trying to find some sort of diplomatic modus vivendi where they can both exploit the resources there and live side by side. Mm-hmm. And in the end, the hotheads in Japan, I guess that's a nice way to put them, are going to basically finally say, no, we're not going to make any more concessions to the Russians. And they look over and they have a very strong belief that their military forces, both on land and at sea, can quickly win a war against the Russians. And the timing is perfect for it, mm-hmm. in that the turmoil back in European Russia is something that they can look at and say, this is an opportunity. So they have the will, they have the means, they have the desire, and they have the opportunity.
And they have seen, if they got a proof of principle that their army performed well against the Chinese,
yep.
performed well against the Chinese again with the Boxers, and I have this brand new shiny toy, let's take it out for a spin. Is that oversimplifying?
I wouldn't exactly put it that way, but it's what they do.
So do the other colonial powers want to allow Japan to have kind of a fair share? Are they shutting them out? Or are the Japanese just simply being kind of aggressively acquisitive here?
It's a great question. I would argue that it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the French, the Germans, and the Russians who certainly don't want the Japanese to go anywhere. However, mm-hmm. Britain, in that constant battle that goes on in Europe between the British Isles and the mainland, and arguably the United States, since we had opened up Japan, and 1853-54, and the Treaty of Kanagawa that had allowed us to open it up, which, you know, the next step for us after that is the purchase of Alaska from the Russians in 1867. Right. So we are Pacific power.
And then the Philippines, of course, as you mentioned.
In 1898. So we are a Pacific power. And our threat, I don't really believe the United States Navy will believe that Japan is a threat starting as early as 1906.
Right.
So right after this war, we're going to see it. I would argue before then, you know, we're on our own in the Philippines, and we're taking care of that, and we're not particularly seeing the Japanese as the threat to the Philippines. The bigger threat is actually the Germans, because they have the possessions also in the Pacific.
Right.
So if we're looking at anybody out there as the bad guys, it's the Germans, of course. We're not really great allies of the Brits, but we share an awful lot of common interests, and that's especially true out in the Pacific.
Right. So it sounds like the Japanese are joining the game, but they're not getting what they want.
Nope.
Okay. So how then do we get to the actual shooting?
It is an attack by the Japanese on the Russian forces in Manchuria, and it is planned as a four-pronged attack. There are four Japanese armies of multiple divisions that will go into Manchuria from on different axes, and so there's an army that will go in kind of halfway up the peninsula headed for Mukden. There's another one a little further down. And then one, and this all starts with an attempt by the Japanese Navy to take out the Russian fleet at Port Arthur. So that is the first action. Mm-hmm. And again, the Japanese are showing a little too much hubris. Mm-hmm. And we will talk about later why they made some very fundamental mistakes. Mm-hmm. There was a very simple thing they had to do, was to take a hill that overlooked the harbor, move their artillery on it, and take out the fleet. They didn't do that for months until they finally got around to it. So this samurai army of the Japanese, that maybe it was a mistake that they won so easily against the Chinese. They didn't have to worry about understanding the geography. Mm-hmm. They really didn't have to be experts in the different weapon systems. Mm-hmm. So this is an army that's led by samurai, older officers who aren't particularly competent. Mm-hmm. The younger officers who've been to the more modern schools, they know tactically what they should do. The problem is, a lot of the Japanese senior officers were ordering them to do stuff that had worked against the Japanese, against the Chinese. Yeah. It's like a human wave attack against the Chinese. Mm-hmm. The Chinese surrender and leave. Mm-hmm. But now, around Port Arthur, where there is essentially a fortress, that you have barbed wire, you have dug-in entrenchments, and you have a competent European army. It's not as well trained, it's not as well manned, it's not got the latest equipment, but it knows how to defend a piece of terrain.
It's good enough.
And this is the hard lesson the British are going to learn, actually a couple of years prior, at the Boer War, when they've been fighting native African tribes for a while, and then they fight a peer opponent, and they realize that they've gotten sloppy.
Yep. And so, when they fight the Chinese, it's not a peer opponent, even though the rest of the world thinks it might be. But when they run up against even a mediocre Russian force, it's a peer.
Now, this is a geographic land grab. This is we've been brushing up against the Russians, and at this point, we're tired of cooperating. We're just going to grab Manchuria and hold it.
Yep. Grab Manchuria and hold it.
So you mentioned there's two key strategic elements to this. One of those is the Russian fleet at Port Arthur.
Yep.
The other one is the Russian land forces in Manchuria. So
yes.
The Japanese have planned attacks on them. As you said, they execute them. I assume these don't work.
No, they don't. And that's the problem, because you had to take out the Russian fleet at Port Arthur to gain and maintain maritime superiority.
Right.
And they don't. And so they are in fear of those forces and logistics that have to come from Japan to maintain the forces that are now, these four armies that are now in Manchuria. They have to be supplied and maintained. And given the losses that they take in the battles against the Russians, they have to keep resupplying personnel.
Right.
Now, there's still a Russian fleet up in Vladivostok that's still doing raiding against. And I think in one of the raids, they sink ships that have got like 2,000 Japanese soldiers on it. That's a pretty, you know, when you lose a regiment at sea,
right,
because you don't have sea control, mm-hmm. That's important. Port Arthur also ties down the Japanese Navy, mm-hmm. because it has to keep
right.
that fleet from coming out and doing even more raiding
right.
to support the raiding that's coming down from Vladivostok. So the Army's mad at the Navy for not doing its job. The Navy's mad at the Army because why haven't you guys taken Port Arthur yet?
Mm-hmm.
This is an easier job on land than it is from the sea, and why aren't you doing your job?
Mm-hmm.
And generally, incompetent, old samurai generals left over are not doing well. And so the Japanese have to revert to human wave attacks, called in the literature of the time the human bullets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the reference is to a memoir of the war that's called Human Bullets, and the line in the memoir is, "We are bullets fired from the gun of the emperor," the soldiers are. So characterize the fighting on land for us a little bit. I mean, you mentioned human wave attacks, but this is also the era where we're starting to see modern industrial military technology like machine guns and recoilless artillery. So what is the ground fighting like?
It is really a mixed bag. So if you look at the fighting in the American Civil War, and then you look at the fighting that we're going to see in Europe in World War One,
mm-hmm.
It's an in-between stage.
Mm-hmm.
There is maneuver warfare going on up the peninsula. There's a battle around a place called Liaoyang, and then it is an attempt to move and take the capital, which is Mukden,
mm-hmm.
and then once taking the capital, to drive the Russian forces back into Russian territory. So there's a maneuver campaign that's going on the peninsula. But again, these are marches,
mm-hmm.
Horses and wagons, and rail.
Mm-hmm.
The rail lines will supply this. So in that way, it sort of looks like the American Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still maneuver warfare over right. relatively large distances. And then around Port Arthur, it's siege warfare that looks more like World War One trench warfare.
So the Russians have some of these modern technologies. They have machine guns. They have good artillery. As you mentioned, they have barbed wire, which we forget. It seems mundane, but it's a really important defensive tool during this period. So let me ask a question for retired Lieutenant Colonel Nance. You don't have any tanks. Sorry. you don't have a lot of the modern kind of assault weapons and weapon systems. So if you're a Japanese soldier and you're facing machine guns, good artillery, barbed wire, entrenched enemy, how do you approach this tactical problem?
And this is, of course, the fundamental problem we're going to see first encountered by the British in small scale in South Africa, and again with the Japanese here, and we're going to see this is the problem of the Somme.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, there isn't a good way to do it, because what you need to do is you need to have the artillery suppress, and then you need to move up the infantry deliberately. The problem, of course, being is that you must put the artillery on target, you must keep the artillery firing for enough time, you must have enough coordination between your infantry and your artillery to pull that off, which you don't necessarily have. And you have to have heavy enough artillery that you're actually achieving the appropriate effects on the enemy. So if you've got a machine gun dug into a trench or a bunker, it doesn't matter if you got all this light stuff bursting around, it's still going to mow your guys down. Mm-hmm. This is a problem that doesn't get... this is why, you know, I jokingly, but, you know, somewhat seriously, refer to the tank as a solution to all of life's problems. But that is the problem, right? Which is, how do I... And by the by, it's still a problem today. We just have some more toys to play with it. Right. Which is, how do I get from where I am to where I want to be with someone trying very hard to kill me? That last 100 yards... It's happening in Ukraine right now. Mm-hmm. That last 100 yards is a real son of a gun. Mm-hmm.
The only thing I would add to that, and I wouldn't disagree with anything that Dr. Nance said, it is night. Mm-hmm. The Japanese train, and their disciplined forces learn to fight at night. And so at night, you basically do your reconnaissance, you do your movement. The other thing is you use the spade. You dig parallel trenches and then mm-hmm. perpendiculars, and you find a way to get to that last 100 yards, mm-hmm. that men against fire line, where is it reasonable that when you leave your bunkers or you leave your trenches, you can reasonably get to the other side. The real issue also is, and we don't think about it all that much, is a lot of this is about terrain, the masking of line of sight. Mm-hmm. So, competent forces are going to patrol. Competent forces are going to have outposts, and those outposts are going to provide you warning. Mm-hmm. So you have to take the outposts out.
Right.
And if you give somebody long enough to dig in, they're going to dig in placements that the modern artillery of the day still can't take out. Mm-hmm. You don't need that much overhead cover to be protected from artillery. And if you use the terrain wrong and you kind of go up these gullies in between the hills, those can easily be, with machine guns, those are easily covered by enfilading fire. Mm-hmm. And they were. And so the Japanese losses are horrendous. Mm-hmm. Now, in the maneuver warfare, further up the peninsula, as they're going from Liaoyang to Shenyang, Mukden, it's a much more even fight. The numbers of casualties on both sides seem to be a lot closer aligned.
So perhaps a silly question then is, if the Japanese are having problems at the command and control level, the Russians, who are on the defensive for this war, they have the negative object, right? They just have to prevent the Japanese from succeeding. Why then are the Russians having problems?
This is where you get the back in European Russia. They are not able to send more competent troops and better equipment out there soon enough. If the Tsar had been able to look ahead a little bit more. And once they had kind of settled down the revolution back east, and if he'd had patience and timing, the Russians actually could have won this war. Mm-hmm. That's the way it certainly looks at. But at the time, given all that was going on politically, it's time to make the best deal you can. So this war essentially ends with neither side being very happy. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is Theodore Roosevelt at the Treaty of Portsmouth that will bring this together and get the Nobel Peace Prize for that treaty. Mm-hmm. But neither the Russians nor the Japanese are very happy with the results, and it is why the argument is going to be made that we will begin Plan Orange. The United States will begin to try to put together the war plans and op plans against the Japanese. And one can argue that the Russian Far East has always been their weakness. Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't talked about the Battle of Tsushima Straits.
Yeah, so let's talk about the conflict before we get to the aftermath. Yeah. So we're stalled out around Port Arthur. There's a land siege. There's a blockade. As you mentioned, there's also this maneuver portion where the Japanese are maneuvering into Manchuria proper towards Mukden. So how do the culminating battles of the war happen?
While the fight is going on up around Mukden, the Japanese are slowly but surely gaining the advantage. Mm-hmm. And they will take Port Arthur. Port Arthur will surrender once the army takes the heights and starts to pour artillery fire down on to the Russian forces that are basically pinned in mm-hmm. at Port Arthur. So the fall of Port Arthur allows another army to begin to move north. Mm-hmm. So you'll have reinforcements going north.
And one thing that you highlighted just from the previous line is because the Russians are not able to send sufficient reinforcements from the west, the Japanese actually have at least, even though they're a much smaller country, at least have parity, if yep. not local superiority yep. in manpower. Yep. Is that a true statement?
Yeah, I think I put the numbers in one of my pieces here. The Japanese will end up having almost a million troops deployed, plus 700,000 Korean and Chinese porters to mm-hmm. do their logistics work. The Russians just can't keep up with that. Russia, you know, basically started out with 100K in eight divisions with a 24,000 man reserve. So the Japanese significantly outnumber them. And so there aren't enough reinforcements coming in. And so basically Kuropatkin and the Russians just keep retreating backwards. They're trading space for time, but time eventually runs out. And this is where I think the Battle of Tsushima Straits, you know, mm-hmm. comes in. It is literally the destruction of an entire Russian fleet. Mm-hmm. The Russian Navy in the Far East is destroyed. Port Arthur's gone, and this fleet that had sailed all the way from the Baltics, all the way around the world, getting weaker and more maintenance necessary. Mm-hmm. And by the time it gets there to do the fight, it probably should have gone back home.
Mm-hmm. So what happens at Tsushima Strait? This is one of the great naval battles of the century. Yep. So,
not being a great naval historian, you know, I guess crossing the T is what's always talked about. But the Japanese Navy knows these waters, mm-hmm. and the Russians have to get to Vladivostok. They have to get through the Tsushima Straits to the other side. So they basically, you know, take a chance that they can get through. And I think this is where looking at the Japanese, mm-hmm. and then now you probably got to put the racist piece in there. This idea that these Japanese are never going to be as good as the Europeans, and they're certainly not as good as the Russians. Mm-hmm. The Russian admiral basically tries to bully his way on through in a great defensive part of the ocean. And so this very, very good Japanese Navy that has been equipped and trained with, by, and through the British Navy mm-hmm. just does them in. Mm-hmm. I mean, they destroy virtually all of their major major capital ships.
And it's worth pointing out, this is not the Russian Pacific Fleet. This is the Russian Atlantic Fleet that sailed from Europe.
Yep.
And the Japanese lose like one ship or something like that.
Yeah,
it's a completely lopsided victory.
And here, I mean, here is something that the United States, I mean, what we're going to encounter at Guadalcanal mm-hmm. With six naval battles over that year-long period, of which we lose five of them, is a very competent, well-trained, well-equipped mm-hmm. Japanese Navy. So at the end of the day, as at the Battle of Jutland, mm-hmm. you know, who's got the best, who can fire best?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, who can put more shots mm-hmm. on ships mm-hmm. Matters.
So Tsushima really ends the naval war as a decisive victory for the Japanese. How do we end the land war around Mukden?
It will end it basically with the as I understand it, the Russians will be retreating, and the Japanese will be slow to follow up because they've taken such great losses.
Right.
And so, but they're pushing them back towards when the ceasefire, you know, then and the whole idea.
So the question comes up, if both sides are unhappy with the treaty, why is T.R. Roosevelt able to get them to sign the treaty?
Yeah, so let's talk about the diplomacy, and let's answer that question in some detail. All right, so now we have the Russians, as you mentioned, serious unrest at home. We'll culminate in a revolution that will create the Russian parliament, the Duma, and presage the fall of Russia. And we have a victorious Japan, although one that's spent a great deal of bodies to get there. So, first of all, why is an American brokering a treaty anyway?
Theodore Roosevelt is an interesting man. He foresees the war coming with Spain in 1897-98, and he orders the U.S. Asiatic Fleet to immediately attack the Spanish fleet as soon as the war begins.
Right.
And so the American fleet will leave Hong Kong and go down and win the Battle of Manila Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at this kind of the historic piece, opening up of Japan 53-54, buying Alaska, and then colonizing and buying the Philippines from Spain after victories both on land and at sea, you know, we are poised to be the Pacific power.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, we are joining. There's a hint of this before. In 1860, in the Second Arrow War, French and British forces go offshore to fight at the Daku Forts. There's an American admiral there with ships who will actually support that.
Mm-hmm.
So we are absolutely into colonization. It is a very, very split America. You know, if you go visit Mark Twain's home in Hartford, Connecticut, there are a lot of people that are against moving manifest destiny beyond the shores of the continental United States.
Right.
And so the nation is split between the isolationists and the globalists in the modern day terms of it. But Roosevelt is one of the globalists.
Right.
So this arguably also in terms of prestige for the nation. We are hosting a major conference of powers.
It's the Treaty of Portsmouth, after
it's
all.
It's the Treaty of Portsmouth. So, for all intents and purposes, then, it's a lot Teddy Roosevelt.
Yep.
And it's a lot Teddy Roosevelt attempting to show, I think, the American people that This idea of the United States being a global power, at least a regional power in the Pacific, is valuable.
Okay.
And so it follows up what he had done in the Philippines 5 years later. It's just well along the track of where he wants to go.
So what happens in the treaty? What are the terms of the Treaty of Portsmouth for both sides?
It essentially, the bottom line is, the Japanese get Manchuria.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the other stuff that's there, the Japanese ask for an indemnity, and the Russians say, no, there's no money going to change hands here. Right. You guys got Manchuria. Now they're back in their home territory, and Chinese Manchuria now belongs to Japan. That's the bottom line with this diplomacy. And at the end of the day, the enmity between Japan and Russia is there. It will stay there.
Mm-hmm.
It will raise its ugly head in 1939 with the Battle of Nomahon.
There's a couple of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Kalkangol, yeah.
And Kalkangol is the other. And so, now the interesting thing is that when the Russians are bogged down again, or back in Europe, they will try to they'll sign a non-aggression pact with the Japanese.
Right.
Which again shows that it for the Americans it's Europe first, and for the Russians it's Europe first.
Right. Right. Certainly. So I think there's two kind of directions of meaning for this war. One of them, as you point out, is kind of diplomatic, strategic. We have a reordering of powers. Japan is now in Manchuria. They're mad at the Russians. They also are mad at the Americans for perhaps not giving them the treaty they wanted. The other one is the military legacy of this war. As you mentioned, it's in many ways it's a midpoint between the style of fighting we see in the U.S. Civil War and the style of fighting we'll see in World War I. So why is this regional war important in a military aspect? Why do we care about the military legacy of the war?
Basically, if the forces had learned from the last war, as they are going into war in 1914, they seem to just ignore the lessons that were here. Mm-hmm. And again, the maneuver lessons are there in terms of logistics and movement of forces over land. But I think the biggest learnings could have been done from what was happening around Port Arthur. Because what you saw there was trench warfare that's going to happen at the end of 1914 in spades there in front of them. Mm-hmm. They could see it. The machine guns, the artillery, the need for human wave attacks and the elan, which the French will certainly play into, are all there. Mm-hmm. And so you have a microcosm of World War I laid out in front of you.
And the European observers are there watching this.
Mm-hmm. There are American observers. There are the full panoply of European observers. Everybody is watching it. And then, in one of the readings that we have reporting back, the lessons were ignored to a great extent, even by us.
Yeah.
What will be later General March, Pershing, they are observers. They see this. Yet, it doesn't seem to sink in. And then you have to ask yourself why. Part of it, I think, is racism, hubris, or it can't happen to us, or won't happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
But it again, that's one of the questions that still needs to be asked. Why do we ignore the lessons of war that are right in front of us?
And of course, there's I'm spacing on the author right now, but he basically says the war is impossible.
Jan Block.
Jean Block.
Must be pointed out is a banker. He's not a military author, so that's why he's ignored a lot. Yeah, and I think one of the things that listeners should take away from this war is it is very much after World War I, people look back at it and say, oh, you should have learned those lessons. But, you know, people are not always good at taking the lessons that are in front of them.
I think, you know, as we put this war into our curriculum, which I think is a great idea for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, getting the American military officers oriented towards the U.S. Indo-Pacific, then they're going to get Sun Tzu and Mao, but here they're going to get to see Japan, our ally now, and Russia, the other one of the four national security strategy, you know, potential adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see a little bit about them. And as we saw, or as we are seeing right now, the first year and a half, the Russians are not doing well in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But as we're sitting here today, they are surrounding Kharkiv and on the move. Again,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that Zelensky, you know, should look at this war and say, why did the Japanese go to Portsmouth? Because they knew if they stayed longer and the Russians got a chance to rebound, they have a tremendous capacity to come back from disaster.
Mm-hmm. And they're fairly resilient in World War I, up until the point when they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Dr. Bab, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
My pleasure.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.